So where we're at right now, we've covered introductions, who material design or what material design is, and sort of, you know, hellos from a couple of Googlers on the call. And at this point, we're going to talk a little bit about a study that we did recently that was focused on identifying the accessibility of component styling. So we called this study the Shadows and Outlines Study because we were focusing on stroke outlines and shadows around different types of components, focusing on chips and buttons. The actual goal here was basically to understand what the contrast ratios might be required in order to identify and interact with things like buttons and chips. I guess as a little bit additional background, buttons we may all be familiar with, but are essentially the buttons that might pop up in a dialog, the buttons that pop up just in common use both on web and on mobile. Chips, there's a few different types of them. Kunal could probably give a more accurate description, but I'm thinking the chips that are, for instance, the auto-suggest or auto-reply content that comes up at the bottom of Gmail sometimes or at the bottom of chat windows, those are examples of chips. They're typically rectangular with rounded corners. Another example you might see them is in filtering, where they reflect input from the user. So say if you're looking for hotels, you want to find a hotel with a view, you type in view and you'll see a chip, which is again a little pill-shaped rectangle that pops up that says view, that again is sort of like reflecting user input in that way. So that's kind of the two components that we were focusing on, buttons and chips. And again, we were trying to better understand what level of contrast would be required for those buttons and chips to identify and interact with them for both stroke outlines and shadow outlines. As a kind of additional bit of background, of course, there is guidance in WCAG for contrast ratios for text, and I think these are pretty well understood and not that controversial as far as how you identify how they need to be sort of understood and how you try and make sure that you're aligning with them. So that's basically for AA standards, you know, 4.5 to 1 contrast ratio between foreground and background color, 3 to 1 for large text, and then for AAA standards, a 7 to 1 contrast ratio with 4.5 to 1 for large text. So again, those are easy to communicate, easy to understand, and relatively easy to sort of increase your alignment with them. What we ended up finding, and again, the focus of this study was contrast for non-text elements, is that there is a guideline for non-text elements, but it was a little bit more difficult to immediately understand exactly what we need to do to, you know, push towards alignment with that. The guidance that exists says that user interface components and graphical objects must have a contrast ratio of at least 3 to 1 to adjacent colors to meet those requirements. But one of the issues there is the exact nature of what is required for the identification of components isn't really spelled out. And so it's one of those things where we have to ask ourselves, is the stroke outline or shadow outline around a button part of that styling that's actually required for this, or is it not? So, really the goal that we had here was to figure out how we could interpret those guidelines for non-text elements to sort of increase our ability to push for that alignment. And basically with our interpretation of them being that the characteristics of components that are required to identify a component should aim to meet or exceed that 3-to-1 contrast ratio. And second, the characteristics of components that are required to identify a component as interactable should again aim to meet or exceed that 3-to-1 contrast ratio. So that's given the language in the non-text contrast guideline. We, you know, basically aim to operationalize or find a way to understand and increase our alignment with that by those two things. Again, one, to identify it, and two, to perceive it as interactable. So the kind of key LDR for our goal was, number one, determine if components are identifiable, and number two, determine if components are perceived as interactable. While we only vary contrast of styling of stroke or shadow. So that's kind of the background, the impetus for the study, why we were actually doing this was to make sure that we can better understand what the guidelines are, and that we can actually have empirical data that allows us to make sure that we're pushing towards that kind of alignment. As far as the actual setup, I'll just keep kind of going through, and maybe if anyone sees, I'm looking at slides, so if anyone sees a question pop up on our IRC, feel free to poke me. As far as the study setup goes, we worked.
Looks like there's a couple people in the queue.
Oh, okay. Is there anything that?
Seeing as Andrew hasn't actually joined the call yet, I'm guessing that might be there from last week. Mike Gower, you're also on queue, I'm assuming. Is that from last week as well?
Yeah, that's from last week.
Okay. So no questions yet. Sorry, carry on.
Okay. Thank you. And yeah, again, since I'm looking at the slides here, feel free to let me know. So the study setup, we worked with 18 participants initially, with three dropping throughout due to scheduling conflicts. And so in the end, we had 15 participants from our trusted tester panel, where we actually met with all of them once a week for 3 weeks. We really wanted to work with everyone, you know, repeatedly, so we could build up kind of a shared understanding, not just of the questions that we were trying to answer, but could act and collect data from a point of initially, you know, with something that was new, with a mock or a prototype that was new that would be unfamiliar, but then sort of work towards that familiarity week after week, and then have, by the end of week three, be able to collect data from a point of familiarity. So kind of also accounting for things like learnability. So in the end, after 3 weeks, there was 36 separate interviews, 18 hours total spent with participants, and again, 18 hours spent trying to answer two very simple, very straightforward questions. Are these components identifiable, and are they perceived as interactable? The level of time that we spent on this was, again, it was intentional. We really wanted to make sure that we were understanding as clearly as possible, not just what the guidelines were suggesting, but the experience that our participants were having in understanding things.
Oh, looks like David has a question, but the queue is getting weird.
Oh.
Yeah, just a quick question about the 15 participants. Did anyone identify as having low vision or color issues?
Yeah, so it was from our internal accessibility trusted tester panel. All of them had low vision. Most were legally blind. And so the actual conditions ran a fairly broad gamut. Some participants, yeah, would use magnification primarily. Some would use narrator primarily. Some would use Braille. Some would use actually all three throughout the day, which was one of the findings of the study, is that there's a great deal of variability in assistive technology use. especially, you know, at the beginning of the day, maybe experiencing less eye strain, and at the end experiencing more. But one of the recruitment criteria was use of assistive technology. So yeah, all of them.
Perfect.
Let's see. So
this
kind of
this
moving.
Can I jump in for a question?
Yeah,
really
sorry,
John.
Let me use this.
Yeah, I just specifically, I heard the low vision, but did you test with anyone in the aging community or cognitive disability community?
Sorry, who was speaking there?
That's John Kirkwood.
This is John Kirkwood.
Thanks.
So the focus on this specific study was on recruitment for low vision. There were
uh-huh.
a couple participants that were over 60.
Okay.
And so that was one area where we did get a little bit of coverage. Although if we were intentionally recruiting for instance, for elderly populations, we would have emphasized that a little bit more. I would say that on all of our prior studies, and I'm not going to go into these today, maybe at a future date if there's interest, we have aimed to recruit where the sample of the population that we're doing research with is roughly, there's rough parity with the larger population of the United States. And so all of those studies have also included elderly participants as well. And we typically also aim to ensure that there's at least minimal representation from accessibility populations, usually focusing on low vision users.
Okay.
So then as far as the actual study setup goes, it was pretty straightforward. Like I said, it was 3 weeks. For the first 2 weeks, we really focused on digging into issues of identifiability and perceived interactability. Again, those being the two kind of primary questions. And we did that by sort of varying back and forth comparison type questions where we would provide participants with variations of different prototypes. And we would basically open world sandbox style allow them to sort of compare and contrast between them. And then also task-based questions where given an individual prototype and a simple task such as, you know, for instance, if you were looking at Gmail, where would you click to open and compose a message? Those sorts of things. So we varied those for the first 2 weeks, again, digging into identifiability and interactability. And then the third week, focusing more on comparing and contrasting between different versions so that we could start to rank the different characteristics of components. So again, whether it's the stroke or a shadow outline, whether it's high standard or no contrast, and whether it's dark or light mode, on the criteria of both preference, which, you know, for instance, which of these two types of things you like more, and what we were calling pop, which is which of these two types of things really jumps out at you more with regard to those components. So that was the basic setup of the study. Again, it was pretty straightforward, and we really did try to keep things as simple as possible. So there was the smallest distance we could possibly get between the question we were asking and the answer that we were aiming to find. So with regard to findings, we can, you know, jump straight into this. Again, two questions, identifiability and interactability. On identifiability, all participants were able to identify and differentiate between controls, again, those controls, the chip or the button, regardless of the control, regardless of decoration, and regardless of decoration contrast. And so by decoration, I mean the stroke or the shadow. And decoration contrast, we had, again, three versions of contrast, high, standard, and none. The one kind of addition to that is that given enough time and magnification. So all of them were identifiable, but we didn't time box the tasks that we were having them do. And they were encouraged to either let us know whether we needed to Zoom from our end, or they were able to Zoom from their end as well. So this is really identifiability. You know, components were identifiable across the board, given the user that we were working with, plus their assistive technology. On interactability, two participants suggested that components with no outline or shadow may not be interactable, and that's out of 168 total sort of images viewed in this task. All other participants were able to suggest possible interaction patterns. So it is a little over 1.5% where there was an issue with that, and that was with, again, no outline at all. So this would be no shadow or no stroke.
Question.
Sure.
Alistair links to this page.
Asking, would this be representative of the quote chips, just as far as terminology clarification?
Yes. Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, that would be an example of input chips. So chips that reflect user input. And I can, when we send out the deck, I'll make sure that I add in some images of that as well. On this one, I was emphasizing text content to make sure that I could speak through it, and I wasn't referring to images that if you're dialing in, you may not be able to see. But I'll make sure I add that in as well. That's a good point. So identifiability, pretty universally identifiable. Interactability, very small percentage. Looked like there was potentially an issue if there was zero shadow or outline.
Question on the queue.
Oh, okay.
David?
Yeah, just a quick question about given enough time. I just want to kind of get a sense of, like, do you mean given enough time, like 2 seconds or 3 seconds, or do you mean like 30 seconds? Or like, did you notice any of your users like really struggling, but they got it after like 15 seconds, or is it just they had to look at it twice? Or I'm just trying to figure out whether it's meaningful. You know, if that's a meaningful quote, like that bracket's actually mean something or not.
Yeah, I would say that the general flow for what we were doing would be, for instance, on the comparison task, looking at either a mobile or a desktop kind of prototype for an application, and especially for the desktop, basically allowing the participant to take a look initially, and I would give them 5 seconds just to take a look initially. So it's definitely more than that. And then I would ask them to sort of describe where they think they are in this application, what if they were using this, what they feel like they might be doing. So it would be basically a way of framing the current context. And then asking them the controls that are currently available, given what they're doing, so that they could explore as necessary. Exploration on the desktop screen sometimes did take 10, 20 seconds, and you know, potentially sometimes longer if they were zooming in and basically scrolling in order to explore the entire view. For the mobile app prototypes, exploration was generally much, much quicker because the display space was much smaller. So zooming in, you could generally see things pretty quick. So I'd say for desktop, it certainly took longer. I didn't time the amount of exploration that they did. And then for mobile, it was generally much more speedy.
Right. I guess I was just wondering did you notice, like, them looking at, like, one control, trying to figure out, is this actually control or not, and kind of looking at it again, you know, were they looking at one thing for, like, 10 seconds? I could understand taking 30 seconds to look at the whole kind of environment or whatever, but I'm thinking about if we're actually focused on a control and trying to figure out whether it's actionable or not. I'm just trying to figure out whether that stuff in that quotes is something that's meaningful or not. You know, given enough time, it means it could be a lot of time. Or
yeah. That is a good point. I think there was very little ambiguity once a control was sort of spotted that was a control. So if we were walking kind of through from the top left to the bottom right of even the desktop screens, which are again pretty large, and just describing the things that we saw, it would be a pretty steady cadence of this is a text box, this is a link, that was a button, this is whatever else, and the button being the thing that we're focusing on or the thing that we're varying the contrast of. That cadence was pretty standard. Like it there weren't things that generally seemed to really throw a wrench into the gears.
Okay, got it.
So those are kind of the initial findings. Again, we had those two primary questions, so we really wanted to focus on that. We have a lot of additional content that's actually included in the deck, so we'll be able to share that out, and you'll be able to see a little more of the background, a little bit more of the details. I can touch on just one of those, which I think is most relevant to the conversation right here, and that is, you know, going back to the question, are shadows or outlines required for the identifiability and the perceived interactability of these components, given, you know, a specific 3-to-1 contrast ratio, for instance? And ultimately, we came to the conclusion that it does not look like they're required for the identifiability of those components. And it's possible that maybe in 1.5%, some contrasting shadow or outline may be necessary for the perceived interactability, or basically identifying the state of components. And again, we can unpack what that means more as necessary moving forward. I think one of the main things, and on a slide I'm showing here, are there's lots of additional attributes of components that were actually called out as being responsible for being able to identify what those things are and being able to understand that those things are interactable. So for instance, different types of component attributes that impact identifiability might include the font color on either a button or a chip, the font size, the font weight, the fill color if there's a background to that button. Of course, there is the stroke or the shadow, the border, but there's also elevation, whether or not they're familiar with the actual language. So if it's something that says okay or cancel or close, that's one of the things where people were like, well, that's a button because that's what buttons say. The actual size of the thing, if there's padding around it, if it was text plus an icon was another where people called out, okay, that's a familiar pattern. Therefore, this is something that is interactable and it's something that I interact with in order to complete this task. I think there was a fair amount of familiarity with those things. And again, all of those sort of attributes of the component had a pretty significant impact on the participant's perception on, you know, how can they identify it and how can they perceive it as interactable. Additional, we call outer attributes that are related to context were also kind of called out as responsible for increasing identifiability. And so that would be, you know, the number of choices. Again, participants suggesting if there are three choices, yes, no, and cancel, I'll guess that those are buttons. The actual display space for the context in which those buttons or chips are deployed, again, have a significant impact on their ability to intuit a pattern of use. things like spacing and justification. So three evenly spaced things at the bottom of a modal dialogue were generally pretty quick to understand that, yes, this is a set of three buttons. And basically general expectation. So if you're on something that you can understand as a messaging type of app, there was a general expectation where they would know where to find the control to send a message, for instance. So I think one of the things that we can call out really, really kind of specifically is that the contrast of these non-text elements can potentially play a role in the identifiability of these things, but there's also all these other attributes. It looks like we have a question.
Yeah, David?
I was wondering about, all of the components that were tested actually had a contrast ratio with the background that was at least 3-1, is that right? They just didn't have strokes or shadows.
So there were between stroke and shadow, for each of those, we tested a no stroke or shadow condition, so no zero contrast, a standard contrast, and then a high contrast. So there would be a total of five prototypes or five mocks for each of those conditions.
Does that mean like I'm thinking like a button, it's a blue button background, so maybe a white text on a blue button on a white background or something like that with no stroke. Would they all have some sort of a background on them that would make them look different than the actual text themselves, the 3-1?
Let's see here.
I believe the, hi David, this is Kunal again. I believe the elements that we tested, we used components whose container color was the same as the background color, but the color of the label was either blue or gray. So there was not a lot of other elements. We kept the background color of the component itself, its container color, the same as like the page background to really isolate the effect of shadows or outlines, because those are secondary styling measures we use for various components in material design. So in our studies, there was not a container color difference to rely on. It was really the text, was a certain color and had a certain content for its label that would indicate it was an action. And then the other elements that Michael was referring to, like the decorations, the shadows or the outlines.
Oh, okay. There's no backgrounds at all. I see that, like what you're showing here. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank God.
It's Mike here. If I can just go back to that. So just as an example, I what you're showing kind of jives with what we found as well. But on the attribute slide 23, I was just looking at, or actually the state one too, where you don't have the outline at all around that, this is failing use of color because the yes, no, maybe does not have sufficient contrast between the blue, the text and the black of the other text. I guess you could make an argument that there's a weight difference and maybe even a point size difference between those. But I would guess that if you withdrew the color, you'd probably still be able to count on it from the padding and the spacing and stuff like that. But it gets a little nuanced about what is actually, you know, how many things in combination do you need until it's clear, and to what number of people?
Yes, that's why slide 22 is my favorite slide in this deck, which is the attributes impacting perception.
Right.
Talking through not just color and the individual attributes of the actual component itself, but the outer attributes. So the context, the positioning, the there's all of the things listed there that also impact whether somebody can perceive it's a button.
Yeah, thanks, Sean.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, I think those, that's a really good point. One of the things that I would love to be able to do is spend more time focusing specifically on to what extent each of these attributes may be responsible for things like identifiability or perceived interactability. And that's one of the things that we could probably tease out, but we would have to do it in a more targeted, directed way, or be as targeted as possible, because really when we're starting to carve into the impact each of these individual things have on, say, for instance, identifiability, there's a lot of different confounds that we have to kind of deal with, and even just the context of the prototype. Are they in a messaging type application or in a kind of media consumption type application, I think has an impact there. So it's one of the ones where I think that there's a lot of opportunity to be able to dig into directly. But at this point, one of the things that we have already identified is just the fact that these are all playing a role. So we can't say whether or not, say, elevation is responsible for 30% of identifiability, but what we can say is that elevation is certainly responsible for some. I think one of the, let's see here. So we've covered kind of the findings and focused a little bit on attributes. Again, there's a lot of content that's going to be below the fold in the appendix for the deck. That's been shared out. So I'll leave that as stuff for future exploration. And of course, we're going to be online. So if there are any questions afterwards, I'd be more than happy to jump on things as well. I'm going to present one more slide here, which is just kind of the recommendations that we've sort of talked about. And this is where I want to kind of open it up to the field to get a better sense on are these the style of recommendations that are useful? Are these the sorts of things that we can actually do? What are the next steps that could be most productive between, Google and WCAG and the style of questions that you might actually want to ask? There is a litany of other questions I would love to kind of get into. But with regard to recommendations, I think being as concise as possible, I had three things that I wrote up in one slide. Two of those three things are with regard to the success criteria for 1.4.11 non-text contrast, the WCAG guideline. The first is with regard to, and I'll go ahead and just read that portion that I'm referring to. So the portion of the guideline says, user interface components, visual information required to identify user interface components and states, except for inactive components or where the appearance of the components component is determined by the user agent and not modified by the author. So there are two recommendations at the beginning of that. Basically, visual information required to identify user interface components and states. Visual information in this context is not really operationalized. And again, one of the things that we did at the outset of this study, one of the things that we were really trying to understand was, how do we increase our alignment with this guideline? How do we understand it to where we can push towards that type of alignment? Visual information is broad enough where we felt we needed to do a study like this just to codify what that visual information is. And so one recommendation that we might have is just increase the clarity, the specificity, or basically increase the have additional guidance that operationalizes what visual information means in that context. And again, it's trying to remove some of the ambiguity that may exist where recommendations can be interpreted in multiple ways or that may
decrease the ability of teams, design teams, to be able to align with those guidelines. So that was the first one. The second one is, again, that first sentence is visual information required to identify user interface components. So focusing on to identify, basically what does that mean? And again, it's kind of like if there are multiple ways of interpreting a guideline, it becomes more difficult to be consistent in the alignment with those with that guidance. So it's trying to identify possible disagreements that may occur. And it looks like there's a question.
Yeah, Alistair.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cough then, not muted. I was just questioning about, so in terms of Codify, would you be looking for like a, you know, here's the aspects of the button that are dictated, here's a checkbox, here's a radio button. Because one of the concerns we had when making this was not to sort of be too restrictive, you know, not trying to dictate that design, and especially given all the factors you've sort of looked into, as these things also affect how people perceive controls. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what that sort of codification would look like to you.
I mean, I think one of the things that seems like it could fit here, as far as that first one, visual information required to identify a component, with focusing on the visual communication, or visual information rather, that by pulling in those attributes that we called out earlier, like those are the visual information, looking at the larger context. So this is a recommendation or a guideline for non-text contrast. And I think one of the things and actually, and this is potentially a question for the group, because I'm not sure, of course, exactly what the best way for that is, but there's an overlap in intent between ensuring that non-text contrast is sufficient for identifiability and interactability and identifiability at large. Identifiability isn't solely under the domain of contrast. And so there's an opportunity, I think, to make sure that the boundary between those is more clear, or it's more, I guess, followable, if that's a word. Just to sort of map out the ambiguity a little bit more directly. And again, I think, this is from my perspective, as far as like creating a study like this, just so I can be comfortable that I'm pushing towards alignment with these kind of criteria. And so it's basically trying to map out any sort of ambiguity. Everything has to be basically as specific and concrete as possible. So I understand that there needs to be a little bit of ambiguity in guidance as far as rhetoric, as far as making sure that it's broadly applicable. But from the user experience of those trying to follow the guidance, there has to be a level of specificity, which is, I think, what I was trying to push for here, so we can feel comfortable that we really are pushing in that direction productively.
Two more folks on the queue, and I think Mike Gower is a good follow-on to that comment.
Yeah.
So kind of along that lines, I'm just something that would be useful to understand as we try to tackle some of that additional information is, I guess, finding out from your team to what degree the understanding document helped contextualize the SC and where you found clarity from the understanding document and where you were left scratching your head.
What? I'm just thinking out of three things, but that's okay.
Sorry, I think somebody's maybe having another conversation somewhere.
So the question being, where does the document, at what level does it get us, and then where do we have to go from there? Is that kind of a way of interpreting that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean,
the understanding documentation. Mm-hmm. And I think the question was kind of how much did that help as far as breaking things down the way that you recommend?
I think it does help. There, basically, a lot of what it is, and we have a study plan where we actually quote at great length all the documents, sub-documents, and basically try and go down the rabbit hole of links and everything like that. I think at the end of that, there is still a need to kind of codify that into a concise statement of, in order to increase our alignment with these guidelines, we have to do A or B or C. And one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we were doing was paying the appropriate amount of attention to the breadth of content that is already there and making sure that we're interpreting it correctly. And it's possible that something like codifying visual information, you know, quote unquote, as it's stated in the guideline, within those documents, could allow us to push forward a little bit more. But even like I at the outset of the study, when we were first laying things out, differentiating between user interface components and graphical objects was one of the things that we wanted to make sure that we were providing appropriate amounts of attention to. So again, I think one of the things that I'm speaking to here is, my experience in trying to understand and interpret these in a way where I feel comfortable as a researcher pushing things forward or kind of interpreting the guidelines in a way where I feel like we're doing it appropriately. It's all about the details, really.
Sorry, just to answer Mike's question in a little more detail. And I think the prior question around how helpful was the understanding content. I do think the examples in there are helpful and provide like a teachable moment for what possible cues might be. I think a challenge, and I wish I had an answer for you, is I know for us and for the teams that use our design system, at least internally, that the question that came up from them was, okay, I have these existing visual styles. I don't see a one-to-one example of like my particular condition to the examples presented in the understanding section, and I don't know how to interpret whether my visual styles like fall under this criteria or not. In our case, as Michael mentioned, we conducted research to answer that question, and maybe that's something that needs to, that's just a recommendation, that's made is some type of auditing measures for designers to better understand, well, what are the elements, that are most important to perceived interaction for their particular application, because we're not going to be able to draft a set of rules that works for everyone. And as much as we can give designers and teams, a hand or assistance in walking through those criteria of what may be important or less important for identifying interactive components within their application, I think would be helpful. This particular criteria versus others feels like it needs to be a sort of deeper self-check and personal evaluation rather than like the text contrast standards, which are much more cut and dry to check.
I'm doing a lot of nodding on my end that you obviously can't see. I guess one thing just to chase up on this, and then I'll shut up and let other people ask questions. Do you think, obviously the balancing act is not making, an entire novel of guidance on this one SC, but I'm wondering if you see any possible value in something which effectively did what you described, where you just you find a whole bunch of examples of UI components, and in some place, you know, have them there, and have the working group go over those and attempt to get agreement on, you know, where, you know, at what point in time do any of these things fail 1411, and kind of try to come up with a almost just a very long list of components. Do you, would you see any value in that, or would that just be a waste of effort?
I think that there could be, you know, value in additional examples, as far as, you know, then if people find an if people have a question, they can go to the guidance, and if they see an example that's in sufficient alignment with the question they have, then their question is effectively answered.
Okay.
The other one being, if there is a way of abstracting the interpretation of what those examples would be showing, then you're giving them a system or a model that they can follow that maybe would allow them to extrapolate to a broader set. That's a little bit more difficult. I think, you know, that could be one of the directions that we could push something like this, is to identify a more systemic way of interpreting guidance that allows you to answer some of the questions you know, some of those questions even before you know what those questions specifically could be. But
right.
By example, I think is still a great step forward, because it does illuminate the area of expression that you're providing coverage for. Maybe the flip side of that coin is that if there's an example that's not covered, then people may assume that their use case is outside whatever, that it doesn't require following guidelines, or it doesn't need to be, you know, in the guidance. But that's more of a content or rhetorical question, not necessarily one that I'd speak to now.
Okay, yeah, great. Thanks very much. And that really confirms kind of what I'm finding in the graphical objects area, where at IBM we're doing a whole bunch of work on complex visualizations in terms of graphs and stuff. And I'm finding that, yeah, obviously there's some considerations for 1411 here, but you also end up having, just like you have on that slide on your contextualization of other considerations, you have a whole bunch of other things that tend to come into play. Your slide 22, other attributes of you know, the component or complex visualization that go beyond non-text contrast, but kind of come into play as you consider, you know, which is more important in any any situation. So thanks. I will now be quiet.
Okay, and we. Yeah, do need to wrap up. I just had sort of one comment question, and then I think David's also in queue. But just to follow on from what you were saying previously, we had tried in the understanding document to abstract in a lot of the cases, and we did go through a couple of design systems. So, for example, I remember going through what was then the recently updated Google Material Design, and trying to make sure that there was at least a version of each one that would pass in a kind of reasonable way. But it would be really useful if you have examples where you were still left wanting, as it were, if you could somehow sort of provide those examples and saying that these are the difficult ones, just as a, you know, a list of links through to particular examples, that would be really useful. David,
absolutely.
Are you still on cue?
Yeah. Let me just get a couple minutes here. So first thing is, it was really hard to make the success criterion. that's why it didn't get into 2.0. Have a non-text contrast, and it was really hard to get things that are, you know, what can we actually measure? And so like what I'm hearing from your list of things that create, you know, a cognitive awareness of a button or not, you know, there's a whole bunch of things in there. I think it would be helpful, at least for me, it'd be great to get kind of a list of things that you think that we could actually codify that would apply across across websites that we could add in addition to contrast that would help, you know, that we could maybe balance them against each other, you know, some of those other factors. In 2.2, there is a proposal for positioning of the label as, you know, in proximity of the thing, but the proximity thing is really hard because the design's always changing. As far as passing, what you know, if those, if you go to slide 31, the things that pass, things that don't pass at the Wiki. So if you don't have any border at all and you don't have any background whatsoever, everybody's kind of treated the same, and you know, it's kind of punishing everybody equally. So therefore, it's not a failure of WCAG to, you know, just put text there like that. As soon as you put a border around it, then to pass the current success criterion, it would need to be 3-to-1. That border would need to be 3-to-1. So that's just a small point on that. I guess that's it. Just if you have other things that you think, you know, this is all about contrast, this one here. So we don't have any positioning requirements at this point. We just have, you know, the color is a big one. And I think that maybe going forward when you're doing testing, you know, I heard John Kirkwood's question, did you have anybody who had a cognitive disability? That's an area where we want to really expand our information gathering. Any users you can get that can, you know, input into that, that may affect the results also. The other thing is people who are colorblind is very different than people who have low vision. And I'm guessing in your list of 18, when you started, or 15, there may not have been anybody who was, like, colorblind. In fact, we did a study for the Canadian government where we tested maps, and the maps that had color, the low vision people loved them. They thought the color was amazing because it gave them so much more information. And so it was a very different crowd from the people who are colorblind. And so we may have missed them in this study here is what I'm saying. I guess that's it.
Mm. One question I have, this is Jen Devins from Google, is on this note, I think everyone agrees, I agree totally with you, Michael, David, if we could get more than just contrast into this. But it sounds like everyone's on the same page with obviously more research needs to happen. And I wasn't sure exactly how this working group works and if you guys actually do your own research sometimes or how we could maybe partner and push that further along. And maybe that's a discussion for another time, but I'd love to follow up on that.
Yeah, I think it is good to sort of get into the next steps. We do need to wrap up, I'm afraid. But in terms of research the working group does, W3C is essentially a member organization. There has been certainly a coalition of a lot of research by the Low Vision Task Force, which informed our sort of initial work on 2.1. Michael, do you want to jump in there? Sorry, Michael Cooper, I'm assuming.
Yeah. So this working group, I don't think does its own primary research. We do raise research questions, but in the Web Accessibility Initiative, under the Accessible Platform Architectures Working Group, we have the Research Questions Task Force that tries to identify research questions and stimulate research in the field on them. So, you know, that might be something where this group would forward it to them, where the research questions could be more elaborated, and then they could work with you guys on executing research.
And I'm sure the group would love to have a little chance to try and digest the presentation, and I'm sure more questions will come up. So that would be good. And I was just wondering, you know, if we do have, an email conversation about it. Michael, I think you said you're sort of happy to talk about it. I'm just trying to think about venue. Would the WAY interest group email list be okay for that, which is a public list, or would you rather sort of keep it to the working group?
I think it should be fine to, because everything that we're sharing here has been, you know, approved to share. So I think the public list is fine. So I defer to whatever standard practices on your end.
Okay, I will send a follow-up email to you and the list, just saying as a sort of introduction, and then if you can reply to that with the presentation link, that would be great.
Okay. That sounds good.
In which case, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to sort of digging in and thinking about that a bit more and looking at the understanding document and working out where we go next. Thank you very much.
Absolutely, and thank you all for, you know, setting aside the time and listening to us. You know, again, from our perspective, I would really love to get a better sense on how we can productively contribute, how we can not just share research that we've already done, but get a better sense on how we spin up the next study in a way that we can both deliver value internally as well as deliver value to you guys as well. So that would be, I think, one of the things on a very short list that I'd really love to tackle.
Yeah. Well, one obvious avenue would be for somebody to join the working group and or low vision task force who have a lot of sort of the wider research knowledge as well. So maybe that's something we can follow up on later.
Okay, that sounds great. But
okay.
Thank you again so much.
Right. Thanks everyone from Google. And then we will switch gear slightly.
Yeah, thanks. Signing off from here.
Signing off. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Everyone else has left the call.